Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, this is Leslie Gist. You listen to the Gist of Freedom. Tonight we have a very special guest, Queen Quick. Are you on the line?
Yes, ma'am. How am I to do this evening?
Oh, I'm doing very well. I'm glad that we were able to make the arrangements so that you could be on our show. I know that you have a special
glad
event.
Glad to be here.
Okay. Could you introduce yourself to the Gist of Freedom's audience?
This year, the Queen Quit head from the body of this year, Gullah Geechee Nation, down in South Kakalaki, North Kakalaki, Georgia, and Florida. I'm Queen Quit, and I'm the head of state for the Gullah Geechee Nation that goes through all the Carolinas, South Carolina, North Carolina, and then into Georgia and Florida. So I'm glad to be here on the air with you.
Great. I'm ready to learn. I have my pencil and my paper ready to take some notes. Now, I'm curious. I've heard the Dismal Swamp, and it seems like the Dismal Swamp is very similar to the areas that you just talked about. Is there a correlation?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because that's one of the things that often happens when people are really not familiar with our area. They speak a lot about swamps, although there are some places here that are like along the Ogeechee River where there's swamplands and there's dismal swamp and so on, and there's some swamps and woodland areas. The Gullah Geechee Nation goes from Jacksonville, North Carolina to Jacksonville, Florida, and encompasses the sea islands and goes 30 to 35 miles inland onto the mainland to the St. John's River. This is largely a marsh area. This is largely a wetlands area and not a swamp area. And the difference is that swamp is stagnant water. It sits. And so with the marshland, because we are directly in the Atlantic Ocean, that water comes and goes every few hours. And so it breeds life. So there are numerous creatures that grow in a marshland area that you do not find in a swamp because of the fact that swamps are stagnant waters.
Okay. Now, when we talk about Guinea, is Guinea a swampland or is it a marsh?
When you said Guinea or Giddy?
Yeah. Guinea in Africa.
Guinea? The country Guinea?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the country Guinea, again, that's one of the areas of West Africa. So, again, it sits on the ocean. And so what separates the Gullah Geechee Nation from Guinea is the Atlantic Ocean. So, again, you have wide open ocean shorelines as well as you have rivers. And so not necessarily swamp. There is a very, very drastic difference between swamps and marsh, especially oceanfront areas. So there's a difference in dynamic between all of those. And Guinea definitely sits out to the ocean side. Part of it does, just as we do here.
Okay. Now, the Geechees, the Geechee culture, where are the Africans? What part of Africa is the Geechees from? Or is there one? No.
Here in the Gullah Geechee Nation, our ancestors were from a range of different countries on the continent of Africa. And so anywhere from the Senegambia region, which encompasses Guinea that you asked about a little while ago, all the way down to Angola, you can pick any country that is along that seaboard, and we have ancestors that were from there as well as from Madagascar. And one of the dynamics that people really truly did not realize in terms of the transatlantic slave trade, which is why our ancestors ended up in North America largely, not all of them because of it, but largely the majority of them came through the transatlantic slave trade. The reason being was that there were many things that went on in the inland portions of Africa that then pushed people toward the coastline, some by choice because they were merchants, but many because of wars that were already being fought. And so people who were prisoner of war ended up along many of the coastlines that we were talking about and then later became part of one of the greatest crimes against humanity that we are now call chattel enslavement or the transatlantic slave trade.
Now, did the slavers choose certain areas of Africa based on the skills that these Africans had? Is that true? Did you find it to be true in your research?
Yes, in my research, one of the major aspects that I often deal with, and people will find this in a lot of the history of musical presentations that I do and on my CDs and other things, is that I point out the fact that we were not randomly kidnapped. People were just not just taken in a tizzy. Many times they were studied to know what their skill sets were. And that is why specific regions that became forts and enslavement castles along the western coast of the motherland became areas where cargoes, as they called us, were taken from because of the skill sets. And depending on those skill sets, whether it was blacksmithing and architecture or it was agricultural and related to rice cultivation, which does involve a great deal of engineering as well, if it was any one of those things, depending on what type of plantation people were being taken to, and plantations in general, and when we talk about the United States, the early formation of the colonies, then you're talking about actually getting people with what we call today skill sets, first and foremost, and then kidnapping them, bringing them in, so that they now would build this new place that was first the colonies and now the United States of America. So definitely the Africans were skilled labor, they were not just taken just to be taken. And even in the beginning years, many times they took more women than they took men because they felt that the women would endure and work and so on, and also for breeding purposes, of course. But over time, they started to take a wide variety of various age groups as well as genders, and a lot having to do with the different skills they wanted them each to do on the plantation.
You are full of a lot of knowledge, and I want to slow you down just a little bit. Now, when you talk about taking for breeding purposes, I want to make sure that I talk to you about that, and that's 1850. But let's also talk about, you said, the skill set. So this myth about that they had to get the strongest African for the sole purpose of his labor, physical labor, was that as important as his mental labor, his skill set? Which one was more valuable to these slavers, what he knew in his brain or what he could physically do with his hands?
Both things, one might say, could be equally valued depending on who it was that was doing the enslaving. So whether you're talking about physical wherewithal or mental capacity, either could be equally looked at because, for instance, if one individual was simply brawn, and they were just a person that you knew could go out and carry, let's say, 200 pounds of a bale of cotton, that person might be looked at as, yes, a good laborer, and also oftentimes, again, looked at as probably someone with the strength to breed so that you might get more laborers of that nature. But now the person who has more mental capacity coupled with that physical ability, if that individual is sold somewhere else, that person, the second one, is going to bring in more money on an auction block than the first one who was just physical labor alone. But mental capacity and physical labor combined were really what made an enslaved person, quote-unquote, valuable on the auction block.
Now, what about the specific areas of Africa? Did they have a section of Africa that they said, this is the part of Africa you need to go if you want a strong Mandingo African? Or was it specifically based on the skill set?
The combination of skill sets as well as what was harvested, grown, or produced within different regions, especially in West Africa, were what you'll find in a lot of the documentation of enslavement vessels. You'll find that they'll note that we went to the Windward Coast or the Rice Coast and we got X amount of rice Negroes, or someone else you'll see where they say, well, we have this group of Angolans to sell today, Gola Negroes for sale. And the reason being is those were the ones that they knew had blacksmithing skills. So you have names like Gold Coast because of Ghana and places where gold was found and is found still in abundance. But then you have the Windward Coast, where today's Sierra Leone, Liberia, and that area, you could find not only diamonds, but you could find the rough, but you could find human diamonds in terms of what the people knew mentally to produce, such as Carolina Gold Rice, which is one of the major cash crops here in the Gullah Geechee Nation, along with Sea Island Cotton and Indigo. So definitely every section, every place where there was an enslavement castle or fort, we can find records today, you'll find a name attached to that, like even the Magdalena Coast, because at one point this particular pepper was very critical to industry. And so you'll find those names depending on what years you're looking at, 1600s, 1700s, or the 1800s, and how they change over time in these historic documents.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the Africans brought some sort of crops and food and, you know, the rice and whatnot. What can you tell us about the progression of the white colonists, how they fared after they had the Africans learn how to, the Africans teach them how to eat? Because we know that the pilgrims were dying off when they tried to use white slaves. And they needed help. You know, the traditional story of Thanksgiving is that they needed help with surviving, and Native Americans helped them out. What can you tell us about their diet, and if we help, as African Americans, our ancestors, did we help them survive based on our food and being able to cultivate rice and all these different things that we brought to this country?
Of course, when you're talking about establishment of any country, as they would be called now, but colonies early on in North America and what's now the United States, you have to look at both the dynamics of what the indigenous peoples to the land already contributed as the Anglo people came in onto their lands, and they thought at first these people could befriend them or just do trade, and they'd go back to their own country most likely. And, of course, they fed them, and then different diseases that came with them from Europe began to even infect and affect that population, and many indigenous people started to die off. Some of those indigenous people, of course, intermarried with African people. But the African people that were here, especially within the Gullah Geechee Nation and a lot of the parts of what are the South today, as we call it, had to cultivate foods as part of their daily crops, some of which, like Carolina gold, was sold on the market. But many of the other things that they cultivated, especially in a situation where here in the Gullah Geechee Nation it was a task plantation system and not a gang plantation system, they also harvested a number of other staple goods that we still eat unto this day, such as okra, tomatoes, the corn that already the native peoples were planting, and so on, the gubas, which are peanuts. And so with all of these things, of course, the people who were enslaving the Africans, they were not, quote-unquote, dirty in their hands. So therefore, anything that they ate, even if it was cow meat, they ate it because the enslaved people were the ones who openly grazed this cattle and then later would kill it, and then go ahead and open it, clean it, cure it, and various other things. So, of course, the skill sets, again, of the Africans helped not only the colonies to be built, but kept the colonizers alive in many, many cases, as well as keeping themselves alive over the generations.
Right. I really appreciate how you articulated that point, because, here we come upon Thanksgiving, and traditionally we celebrate what the Native Americans did, but as you mentioned, all those different foods are part of today's American diet, and I think it contributed to them being alive today. And I'm glad that
absolutely. Absolutely, and even when you think about seafood, which is a large staple in the Gullah Geechee diet, that is still a major tradition of Gullah Geechee peoples. We even recently founded the Gullah Geechee Fishing Association to pay homage to our ancestors and to keep the tradition going, because even at this time, people don't recognize and value these types of contributions that African people have made and continue to make in North America as far as sea work traditions go. And most of the country wouldn't eat any seafood if it weren't for people along these coastlines harvesting the food from out of the water, too.
Correct. And I just want you to know, I extended the show. I hope you can stay with us a little longer, because you are so powerful, and I'm learning so much, and it's a great show. I'm glad I'm interviewing you.
I was about to say to you, I saw that there was something going on with your show with the minutes changing, but I don't have more than the 30 minutes.
Oh, no. Okay, let me hurry up and rush my questions in. 1850, you talked about the breeding. Could you talk about the 1850 law, the Fugitive Slave Law Act, which is really not the Fugitive Slave Law Act, it's really the second one, it was modified. The original Fugitive Slave Law really represented, was really key in helping African Americans fight for their freedom. So the second one in 1850 was changed. They kept the name, but it was changed to deputize anybody to so-called accuse a free black of being a slave or a fugitive. Can you talk about how that law affected the breeding of African Americans?
The breeding, did you say?
Yes. Yeah, so you mentioned, that they would choose African Americans for breeding purposes. Now, didn't that business boom in 1850? I'm a little backwards.
I think I know where you're going, but I don't think the two go together. I think they're two totally different subjects.
Right, they are. They're two totally. When you said you can't stay, I rushed it. 1803, the law that was passed, it said that no one could import slaves, bring any more slaves to this country? How did that affect the breeding industry?
Well, what you're referring to, and here in the Gullah Geechee Nation, we did a year-long commemoration of the end to the British transatlantic slave trade. The law was first done in 1802 in Britain and then was to take place a year later within the colonies, which are now the United States. They were to initiate their own law concerning that there would be no more trading of people by 1808 in terms of international slave trading. That had nothing to do with freeing anybody who was already in bondage, or as they would call it, domesticated slaves within the colonies themselves. So what took place was, as of that approach into 1808, there was, number one, never a stopping point to the smuggling in still of African peoples on enslavement vessels. There was still a great deal of smuggling that took place. There were ships such as the Wanderer that came in and others that are still documented all the way up to the Civil War. But when we start to talk about what happens and what type of upheaval is going on, of course, if I feel like I can no longer get this cargo, as they would call us, from elsewhere, I'm not going to be able to import anymore, then, of course, I want to capitalize on my investment. I'm going to either import as many as I can prior to this cutoff date, and I'm going to also try to increase the breeding where people already are. Breeding was a consistent aspect to chattel enslavement because this constant reproduction of people in the enslavement cabins, down in the bottoms, and the various names that we have for it now, was so that the people who were enslaving others could keep up their interest. We were a commodity, and we were also an item. That's what chattel is all about. We were something that could be put in wills. We were something that could be bought and sold. So there's a value attached. So just like you would do insurance today and you would go through your house and look at the various items you have and catalog them, same thing was done with us. So when we were counted, taxes could be paid on us and for us, but also you could have monies that could come to you because of the value of your estate and your plantation by X number of, quote, Negroes, end quote, that you owned. So therefore it was a value to keep breeding and having more and more children born. Part of that was also because in many states, if your mother was enslaved, then the child that is born is enslaved too. Now, if the father was a free man and then he impregnated an enslaved woman, doesn't matter. He doesn't take the child into freedom with him. The child now stays on that plantation. So it now only enriches that plantation and the enslaver by keeping more Africans there and having more bread.
Excellent. Now, we're only down to the last 7 minutes. Let's talk about specifically about the Geechee culture and the language. Just start off and explain, you know. Talk to me as if I'm a 10th grader in high school.
Well, Hunter Chum, the Yeti people are cracky people. I got a shame thing. I got a Hunter Mai, the Yeti, the shame man, and the way that all talk. When you hear people speaking in this manner, you may have heard it, but have no understanding of what it is at all. And that is the Gullah language. The Gullah language developed because of the amalgamation of numerous African languages and dialects. And those languages came together in what is now the Gullah Geechee Nation on the Sea Islands themselves. We've maintained this African language over the generations from the 1600s up until today. Now, there developed a dialect, essentially, or pidgin of the Gullah language that people call Geechee. And Geechee derived by taking loan words from English but putting them still into the syntax and phonetic structure of African languages. So when you hear people say things like, "Hunna gwine over yonder, forget the nguba and think, bring them back here, and if you grit on the kuda and think, bring them here too, yeah, because we need some for nampun this evening." So that would be more Geechee because you're starting to go towards some of the words that are utilized in English. But even when they're used in Geechee, they don't necessarily have the same meaning as they are in Geechee as they do in English. So when you hear the terms Gullah and Geechee, they refer to language, a dialect of a language, and they also refer to the human beings that speak the language and the dialect of that language. And all of it, both the people and the language, originate in the motherland, in Africa. And if someone wants to get more details about it, they can always email the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition at gullegeeco@aol.com, or they can even go to the Gullah Geechee Nation fan page on Facebook and get a lot of information every day about the language, the culture, and the traditions that continue to live on.
Now, while I was researching the Gullah culture, I ran into a blogazine, a Geechee blogazine. Is that part of your organization?
I'm not sure about the blogazine. We do have an e-zine called The Conk, and we also have a blog that is part of our MySpace page for the Gullah Geechee Nation, and we also have a blog that is on www.officialgullahgeechee.info. So there's a number of different things that come out of the Gullah Geechee Nation headquarters and the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition that you might find on the Internet. But if you want to verify facts, definitely email us and we can let you know if that's actual information from us or if it's something that someone else may have posted.
Now, how did a African-American slave, how was it that this language was able to survive slavery? Because it seems like the master would have not allowed this kind of talk to exist on the plantation.
One of the first things that I often have to point out to people is people who were not African American didn't even use that term until well into the latter part of the 1900s.
And I just want
and
us
so
to
we're talking about African peoples who were enslaved, and people of African descent in North America have a range of cultures. And when you talk about the Gullah Geechee Nation, our whole geographical landscape is different than that of, let's say, Virginia. It's different from that of Mississippi or Alabama, and definitely of, say, New York or California or Illinois. And so when you talk about the dynamics here, you have to take into account the fact that we were the black majority and that our region was not one where we had a great deal of interaction with people of other cultures, even until the 1980s, and we have been here since the 1670s. So there was not an extraordinary amount of interaction onto the Sea Islands themselves until we start getting into the 1950s when bridges are added. The 1960s, you start getting gated areas into the 60s and the 70s. And then in the 1980s, there is this onrush for resorts. And so that's when you start to get a lot of outsiders coming in, and that's when you start getting a lot more interaction with other cultures, especially mainstream American culture and language. So our language and traditions have been maintained because of the wherewithal of the African people themselves, for them knowing they had a right to be free, they had a right to speak their language, they had a right to keep their traditions. And so they never just stood down and bowed down during enslavement, but always held up that which was their own. And so we're thankful that they did, so that today we still have a very unique culture and community that is that living link still back to the motherland for all of the other brothers and sisters that are part of the African diaspora, that are part of what is now African America.
Okay, so you're saying that this Geechee land was a safe haven for the freed African Americans? Freedom seekers?
What I'm saying is that there is a whole, and we can't spend all the time on it tonight, what I'm saying is that our culture existed here all the way from the 1670s up to now. because of the ability of the people. It had nothing to do with whether it was an area as a safe haven. That's a whole nother topic and dynamic for the discussion of maroonage and so on that took place alongside the plantation era. And again, if you go to Gullah Geechee TV, I've discussed this in depth on YouTube on a number of things, and also I have a radio program and I discuss this topic in depth. But in this region, period, it had more to do with the ability of the people to maintain their own culture. And it had nothing to do with what somebody else was going to do to you. It had everything to do with what you were going to do for yourself.
Excellent. Last question. You're going to be celebrating something, an event. Could you talk about that, and then we'll be done with the show tonight?
Sure. We have different festivals every month of the year, excluding December and January here in the Gullah Geechee Nation. So whether it is in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, or Florida, along our coast. And we have a brand new event that's coming up October the 30th, 2010, beginning at noon on historic St. Helena Island in South Carolina. And it is the Gullah Geechee Seafood Festival. And so you'll be able to learn a lot more about the traditions of sea work in our community, see cast nets being made, see some of the bateau boats we still make the same way that our ancestors did it, as well as be able to nampa and a little bit of the thing where we to get from the sea and things like that. And so you'll have plenty to eat just the way we do from everything we harvest from the ocean and the sea around us. So definitely if you want more information, you could go to www.gullahgeecheefishingassociation.com. It's long, but if you go to that website for Gullah Geechee Fishing Association, you will be able to download a flyer for the event, and you can also email the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition that will be helping to support and sponsor the event. And again, our email address is gullgeeco@aol.com. And even to get on our mailing list for these types of events, you can also call our headquarters at 843-838-1171, 843-838-1171. So definitely the thing that we're focused on at all times is celebrating our people, our culture, and our living traditions. And so definitely that's part of the gist of freedom. So we thank you for having me on this show and thing like that. We're so glad it's a day with Hunter Chillin this evening, and we hope to see some of Hunter Chillin coming down here, but yet more for who we are for the Gullah Geechee Nation.
Great. We're going to post a YouTube video on the blog page of Queen Quet, and I apologize that we didn't have a longer time with the Queen, Queen Quet, and we'll have all that information on the website. We also have a slideshow up right now. Please mark your calendars. If you can't go, send someone from the area and let them take snapshots and tell you all about it. And again, thank you so much, and please come back to visit us. And what is the name of your blog talk radio show again? Or your blog show?
My blog talk radio show is called Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio. And Rhythm is R-I-D-D-I-M, so Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio, and it's on Monday evenings at 7 p.m. So folks can definitely, if they tune into your show, they can just search for that one and tune in as well, and we definitely archive the shows, and they are on iTunes as well, so that way they can keep up with all of what is going on, don't you?
And we can also just use the keyword Queen Quet. That's very easy for me. Can we find you on
yes.
the Queen Quet on the blog talk? Okay.
Yes, definitely.
Quet.
If you use the keyword Queen Quet, I will pop up on there too.
Okay. We'll be listening to your show here in New Jersey. Everybody, make sure that your kids hear Queen Quet show. It's very important. Don't go down to South Carolina or North Carolina without learning about the Gullah culture. Have a great night and celebrate hearty.
Thank you so much, Mr. Leslie. You keep up the good work and definitely keep letting folks know our stories of freedom.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Peace.
making Daddy cry.